to welcome you to the third of our 1993 spring series of lectures. Institute lectures are open to all without entry fee, but our program is dependent on the financial support of our members. I would urge you to join the Institute if you have not already done so. Membership fees are modest and they are tax deductible. Before introducing tonight's speaker, may I remind you that next Saturday evening, Moshe Safdie, the designer of the new Vancouver Public Library, will talk on the subject of architecture in search of the public dream. Before introducing tonight's speaker, I should say that we have an overflow crowd tonight. There are some in lecture room number six as well, so that immediately after the lecture, we will go to lecture room number six and take a few questions before returning here for the balance of the question period. The rooms are linked, so you will be able to hear the questions and answers from lecture room number six. Our guest tonight is Dr. Carolyn Merchant, Professor of Environmental History, Philosophy, and Ethics in the Department of Conservation and Resource Studies of the University of California at Berkeley. Professor Merchant's work examines ecology from a new and challenging perspective, which combines insights from environmental history and women's history. She has a degree in chemistry from Vassar College and a PhD from the University of Wisconsin in the history of science and philosophy. Her major book, The Death of Nature, Women, Ecology, and the Scientific Revolution, first published in 1980, is increasingly regarded as a classic in the field. It has been translated into several other languages and has recently been republished in a second edition. Professor Merchant has published two books since The Death of Nature, Ecological Revolutions, Nature, Gender, and Science in New England, and in 1991, Radical Ecology, The Search for a Livable World. She maintains a prodigious lecture schedule throughout North America and Europe. Through her books, articles, and lectures, Professor Merchant is a vigorous and influential voice in current public policy debates on environmental issues. Professor Merchant is here as a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor at UBC. Her subject tonight is Reinventing Nature. Professor Merchant.
Well, it's an absolute thrill to come to Vancouver and to see so many people here who are interested in how we're going to go about this process of reinventing nature. And it might be a bit arrogant to use that term, reinventing nature. And the reason I chose the concept for this lecture is that it results from a series of conferences and symposia that we are currently holding at the University of California at Berkeley and throughout the University of California system. The topic in general is sponsored by the Humanities Institute of the system-wide nine university campuses. The idea of reinventing nature comes about because we need to recognize the full extent of the way in which, as human beings, we impress upon our concept of reality structures, concepts, politics, and history, all of which go into building up what nature means to us at any given time throughout the whole, really, development and evolution of human beings and their time here on Earth, but in particular since the 17th century scientific revolution, people in Western Europe and North America have constructed the concept of nature in a particular way. And that idea of reinventing nature that is the topic of this whole series of symposia that we're holding at California suggests that there is something different or perhaps something wrong with the concept of nature that we've had for the past 300 years, and maybe it's time to do something new and different, to redefine, to reconstruct, and to reinvent the way we, at least in North America, relate to the world around us. If we look at one of the most influential philosophers of recent times, Martin Heidegger, and start with a quote from his essay, The Age of the World Picture, we come to this idea of picturing the world, which is one way of inventing nature. And what Heidegger says is the following. The world picture does not change from an earlier medieval one into a modern one, but rather the fact that the world becomes a picture at all is what distinguishes the character of the modern age. So the modern age generally would refer to the period after the Renaissance, basically the 17th century, when we saw not only the rise of nation states, but also early capitalism, and especially the scientific revolution. And it forms the way we have looked at the world through science and through technology right up to the present. There are a number of people that believe that the modern way of representing nature, of looking at nature, is now, in a sense, out of date, and that we are entering a postmodern period in which we are redefining a lot of aspects of the way we have known life in this past 300 or almost 400 years. Perhaps the most significant way of thinking about the world picture is through the concept of representation. A picture represents something in the world of nature, the world of non-human nature. And the idea of a representation is to bring something to mind, to present it again, to represent it. It evokes a prior presence. And this picture or representation is, in a sense, a copy or imitation of something. It's a proxy for something that is absent. It's a stand-in or a surrogate for some stable object in the so-called real world. Well, this idea of representation arose in the 17th century with the split between the mind and the body, or the thinking substance and the extended substance of Descartes, the res cogitans and res extensa. And like Descartes' dualistic world, the idea of a representation assumes that there is a person, a thinking subject, and a real object, and that the representation is somehow a mediator between the two. So there are three parts to this, the subject, the object, and the representation. This idea assumes that there is a separation between the subject and the object, that there is an external world and an observer. And it also assumes that the subject sees the external world through vision, and vision is the dominant of the five senses, beginning with the Renaissance. And especially in the scientific revolution, this idea that through vision, you are separate. There is a separation between subject and object. Vision emerges as the dominant sense in the 17th century, and even prior to that in the Greco-Roman period, as reading and literacy and mathematics are developed, the world in general moves out of an oral culture where words are spoken and handed down from generation to generation. And also other cultures, pre-modern or tribal cultures, are mainly embedded in an oral culture. And through the rise of science and technology in the Western world and the increased literacy, and especially also because of the dominance of the Judeo-Christian worldview, God is said to send down his word in the form, in written form in the Bible, and that becomes the sign or the symbols that is used to understand God's creation, nature, the natural world. So vision is the dominant sense, and it's very intimately linked to this notion of representation. If we move into the world coming from the 17th century up to the present, we can see here that that vision goes deeper into the mind, so that we have a mind's eye now, which becomes analytical reason, not just the physical eye, which looks at the world and observes it and does experiments, but it becomes very mathematically oriented. And mathematics becomes the key then to understanding the natural world. Anything that can be reduced to a mathematical equation means that nature can be predicted, and if the nature can be understood and described through mathematics, it can then be predicted and controlled and dominated through science. So here we can see, based on the idea of the res cogitans, or the thinking subject, that we have cognitive maps of the world. And perhaps the most important map that has developed in our lifetimes has been this image of the world as seen from outer space. This is referred to as the whole Earth image. And here it's a three-dimensional plaything that we can toss about and take to the beach, perhaps, and throw around. And this is called here the whole Earth ball. So the whole Earth image is the representation par excellence of this scientific worldview. It implies an object, the Earth, seen from outer space by a subject which is totally removed and alienated from it and sees it across the vast expanse of space. And in fact, here the subject is so reduced in size and the Earth is so enlarged as to become an immense whole of nature. So the subject can know this whole of nature from outer space. The idea of the whole Earth is based on the clock-like mechanistic universe of the 17th century, and it was Newton's laws of physics and projectile motion which were at the basis of our ability to send astronauts into space in the first place to take pictures again through the camera, which is, in a sense, the machine par excellence of vision. And even today, the idea of the Earth as a system, a total system of interacting, interrelated parts, is an extension of this mechanistic or clock-like universe. Now, what I would like to do with this idea of the whole Earth image is to contrast it with other images of nature and other ways of relating to nature that we have seen in the past and that we also can get in touch with through other cultures, and to see what other cultures have to offer us, what we can learn through this kind of contrast between our image of the Earth and other people's images of the Earth. In the 17th century, the world was represented here in Athanasius Kircher's book, Mundus Subterraneus, from 1678. In a sense, this is like a whole Earth image. It's round, it's on a piece of paper. It is basically a representation, but it is a very different kind of representation than this whole Earth image, which I have here in the form of this beach ball beside me. In this image, the Earth is alive. It is active. It is not a piece of clockwork like the mechanistic worldview, but it is the image which most people have had of the Earth from the Renaissance back into prehistory, and which many tribal peoples hold, that the Earth is a mother, the Earth is alive. In the center of the Earth here, we have little wombs where life is generated. Rocks and minerals were alive, and they grew in these wombs underneath the surface of the Earth, and they came forth, they sprouted as veins of ore, perhaps. One of the images was that of a golden tree, a tree in the center of the Earth filled with gold. And if people mined those veins of ore, which is again an organic term, they could take the ore away, but in a few years it would grow back. So even what we think of as inanimate is actually, in the pre-modern world, a living thing. And it looks as though these are parts of a human body. Here we have perhaps veins and circulatory systems, veins and arteries, which became the circulatory system with the work of Harvey. And here in the center, we have fire, the source of energy and the source of motion, which keeps this earth alive, and it has a very active volcanic kind of interior, and you can see volcanoes spewing forth smoke here on the surface of the earth. Lucretius spoke about this earth as a living thing. He said, in the beginning, the earth covered the hills and all the plains with green and flowering meadows in rich color. When the earth and air were younger, more and larger things came into being. The earth was indeed prolific, with fields profuse in teeming warmth and wet. The earth, said Lucretius, deserves her name of mother, because the rich fields were like wombs. The creatures were like embryos. They were pores or ducts of the earth, channels from which a kind of milk-like juice would issue, as a woman's breasts are filled with the sweet milk after her child is born. And that very well describes this 17th century image of nature. The image of nature then in the Renaissance, prior to our period of the clock-like world picture, was one of deep immersion and engagement with the natural world. And this bears very important similarities to the way that tribal peoples have viewed the world. Here we have the testimony of Diane Brown here in British Columbia in 1985 to the British Columbia Supreme Court. And this is in the matter of the Haida people picketing logging roads on their island. This way of knowing nature was very intimately participatory. Morris Berman, who worked here in Vancouver for a number of years, wrote a book on the reenchantment of the world. And he talked about the total immersion of people in the world as a way of knowing it, not just through vision, not through just through the analytical mind or the mind's eye, but through the body, through identification with nature. And here in this Haida way, we can see that exemplified very clearly. For Diane Brown says here, I want to touch now on another very important area in my life as a food gatherer. It is my job, my purpose, to ensure that I gather certain foods for my husband and my children. And I want to share one part. It's called glow. That's herring roe on kelp. In the spring, the herring come and they spawn on kelp. For many years now, I've been harvesting that and putting it away for the winter. And she goes on to say, I want to share what goes on in my spiritual self, in my body, come February. And I feel it's an important point. My body feels that it's time to spawn. It gets ready in February. I get a longing to be on the sea. I constantly watch the ocean surrounding the island where the herring spawn. My body is kind of on edge in anticipation. And finally the day comes when it spawns. The water gets milky around it. I share this experience with all the friends, the lady friends, that we pick together, this wonderful feeling on the day that it happens, the excitement, the relief that the herring did indeed come this year. And you don't quite feel complete until you are right out on the ocean with your hands in the water harvesting the kelp, the roe on the kelp, and then your body feels right. The cycle is complete. This way of knowing nature, it comes near to rapture and to communion with nature. And it's a rather different way of knowing nature than the way we have chosen to know nature in our whole earth technology. This illustration from a Japanese technology magazine shows the close relationship between the US and Japan through a communication systems as a way of knowing the whole of the globe through a communication network that allows information to be centralized in one place and therefore, in a sense, a net thrown around the world that will allow us as human beings, particularly Western human beings, and that includes Japan in this particular case, to dominate and control the whole planet. And in this illustration, we can see all this precision technology products as a systems theory, as a network surrounding the Earth. And here, the whole Earth image can be used as an exemplar of this possibility of scanning it, of staying aloof from it, and of modeling it as a machine. It means that we have a privileged vantage point from which to view nature and to make it into commodities for sale on the market. Let's contrast that now with a rather different way of knowing the world, which comes from the anthropologist Richard Nelson, who wrote a book on the Koyukon people of Alaska. And he, as an anthropologist, trained in the Western style of doing anthropology and in Western science at the University of California, or sorry, of Chicago, went then to the interior of Alaska. And over a number of years of working with the Koyukon people, he began to say to himself, I no longer know which is the right way to understand the world. He became immersed in the Koyukon way of knowing. And he writes in one of his recent books about hunting in the Koyukon way, about a relationship which he has with an animal through the hunt. He talks about the deer and how the deer has power. In this image that we have of the satellite technology, the object is basically inert and dead, and it is the human mind that has the power over it. In the Koyukon world, the deer has a power, and the deer has power not just as an individual deer. It has all the deer power of all the other deer with it, and also the bear power and the salmon power. Those spirits are all there in that world at that moment of encounter, of interaction between the Koyukon hunter, or in this case, Dick Nelson. And he writes, "This is a very large buck. It comes so quickly I have no chance to shoot, and then it is so close I haven't the heart to do it. 50 feet away the deer lowers his head. In the middle of a step he raises his head all the way up, and he sees me standing there, a stain against the pure white of the forest. A sudden spasm runs through his entire body. His front legs jerk apart and he freezes, all akimbo, head held high, nostrils flared, coiled and hard. I can only look at him and wait, my mind snarled with irreconcilable emotions. Here is a perfect deer. In the Koyukon way, he has come to me, but in my own, he has come too close. I am as congealed and transfixed as he is, and as devoid of conscious thought." The people of the Koyukon and other early peoples in North America knew nature and knew animals through imitating them, through immersion in their world, through taking on their identity as much as possible in order to be as much like them, to mimic them, through a process of mimesis. And here we can see a hunter. This is a person with a deer skin, but the only way we know it's a person, a human being, is that through these feet here. It's very hard to know where the person begins and where the deer begins. They are so immersed into one, and that person has taken on the identity of the animal. Another illustration here from the raven. Again, we know that there is a human being in this costume, ready to dance and to dance with the spirits in the world. Another illustration of mimesis, of taking on the identity of an animal in order perhaps to hunt it, to understand it. Here, a man imitating a seal. And it says the seal first arrives in the air, looks around for a proper place to bask. And then the seal moves across the ice, moves closer to the hole in the ice. The seal lies flat, sun on its belly, feeling the sea under it. So this is a moment in time of transfixion, of transposition into the identity of another being in the world. Another image which is very often used by environmentalists is the web. Environmentalists use the whole earth image and they use the web. And yet both of these images, the whole earth and the web, are imbued with other meanings, meanings which have become associated with them through commodification of changing living beings, living subjects, into natural resource objects and then into commodities to be sold. And here we see a pattern, an image, a natural image. But it is used here to suggest, again, power and control over nature. Here it says, "Bull networks are surpassed only by those that occur in nature. And at Bull, we're dedicated to helping you find the perfect networking solution, whether it's simple local area or complex multi-level or multi-vendor integration. So this is the perfect network, the ideal network that it could apply to anyone, anywhere. It is, again, a single locus of control. It's a representation which becomes a tool for power. And it is multi-leveled and hierarchical. Now, this, even though it takes on the image of the spider, of a web, of a spider web, if this web, this living spider web, were to be destroyed, it would be respun again, and perhaps in a different place, or with a different form, or a different pattern to it. We can contrast this web, this computer web, with an image from Aboriginal people in Australia. This is very much like the pattern that we just saw. It has tentacles and threads moving out from a central place. And it looks as though it's just an image, just some kind of pattern that you might purchase and hang on your wall. But if you look at this illustration, which is called Yamroot Dreaming, you find that, again, it is an image of total participatory consciousness, of participation in a way of being in the world that is rather different from the network that we just looked at. You can see here in the diagram on the side that there is a water source here in the center, and the water soakages here, these dark places, are clues that there is actually a yam root underneath the soil. And so the artist here has shown a part of the world that you wouldn't see just by looking at the sand, but you can actually see the roots coming out. And then if you look more carefully, you can see that there are figures here. And this is, becomes a story. There are women, and there are children, and up here there are other people, and here is a hunter with spears and boomerangs. And then around the edges of it, you can also see that this activity of looking for the yam root is being watched by animals. There is a kangaroo pictured here, and above a crow, and there are children on the side, and over here a dog. This is a lived experience that tells a story, as all Aboriginal paintings do. And it is a story that is very different from the kind of story that Western science and technology tells about the world. And the contrast is captured here by the Australian artist John Woolsey, when he says that when such an image takes the form of a giant ritual painting on sand, as opposed to this Western-inspired acrylic version on a piece of board, its importance is over when the ceremony has been completed, and then it is left behind to be smudged by the feet of geckos and blown away on the desert winds. Woolsey says that seems to me to be the most symptomatic illustration of the difference between the two attitudes to art, the ultimate dislocation. For the urban art product will probably end up as a separate entity on a stranger's wall, appreciated in terms of its relationship to the color of the curtains, or as a totemic expression of its financial value. Well, I had not read this passage at the time that I purchased such a painting from the Central Desert people in Australia. And I chose it exactly because it would go with my carpets and my curtains, and also because I knew it would have financial value in California. Let's take another example of the use of the whole earth image and see it as a landscape. This is a landscape as shown from the moon. It's a lunar landscape. And over the edge of the surface of the moon, you can see the earth, again, a whole earth image. This is a landscape which is totally artificial, and in a sense, it epitomizes what mechanistic science and technology have brought to us. Not only is it an escape from the earth and the effort to set up another home, which it could not ever possibly duplicate, but it has moved us away from home on the earth to the moon. And it shows here tracks and tracking devices and satellite dishes. And it's even here Christmas on the moon. And you have a Christmas tree out here in the lunar landscape and Christmas presents being transported on tracks by various little trucks moving around outside the space station that has been built there. The landscape in Australia for Aboriginal people, again, contrasts with this. An anthropologist named Diane Bell went to work with Aboriginal women. And she said that when she first drove the highway to the place where she was going to do her study, that she just simply couldn't cover the distance fast enough. It seemed like a totally barren landscape, much like this lunar landscape that we see in the illustration. But after she had been there and worked with them and become a member of their community, she says, "Now I can barely drive a mile without seeing something worthy of comment. In what was once open spinifex plains broken only by an odd acacia stand, I now see highly differentiated foraging grounds, rich in small fruits and goanna," a lizard. "In burned-out plains, I now see prime hunting ground, and I wonder whose fire burnt through here. Local people always know who has lit a fire, because only persons in the correct relationship to a particular tract of land may do so. In the wide, dry creek beds, I now find the wild potato runners. I recognize the potential water sources, the places where frogs may be hidden deep in the cool, damp sand. I scan the horizon for smoke. I see a red tinge in the rock, and I look for ochres." This is, again, a way of totally immersing oneself in the landscape of nature that must be sung to, of parts that must be danced to, of a way of bodily knowing knowing nature through the body, not just through the mind's eye. At the World Wilderness Congress that was held, many environmentalists went to speak about the scientific importance of saving wilderness. And the whole concept of wilderness now has become something abstract in the sense that it assumes that there are no human beings living in that wilderness. It's become very ethnocentric. It assumes that for the last 10,000 years, perhaps in North America, that there has been no human presence. It blots out the existence of Native Indians. And the Wilderness Bill, the Wilderness Act, that was passed in 1964 in the United States, says that it defines wilderness as a place where man and his presence is only felt in a transitory way. There is no area on the surface of the planet, basically, that has not been shaped by human presence, has not been changed by it, where people have not lived and interacted with their environment. So at this World Wilderness Congress, all the learned Western speakers gave very eloquent treatments about what wilderness was, why it was important, why it should be preserved. Their speeches represented wilderness as a general concept, as something that would apply to wilderness in general as an abstraction. And at the end of the conference, a Zulu chief got up to speak. And he was the one who began not by talking about the abstract concept of wilderness, but he just got up and said, "I'd like to talk to you about some of the animals where I live." And he described the wildebeest and what it looked like and where it lived and what it liked to do, and under what circumstances it liked to do these things, and at what time of day it would appear, and at which water hole. And then he went on and described the kudu and what it looked like and how it associated with particular other animals, and how it often looked in a certain way, but sometimes it looked in another way. And he went on to the water buffalo and the zebra. And his conclusion was, "I wish I could tell you about all the knowledge of my people about the land, the animals, the birds, the plants that are a part of our lives. I have really only just begun to tell you." Now, these examples which I've chosen have, for the most part, come from pre-modern peoples, as in Western Europe, or they've come from tribal peoples, Aboriginal people in Australia, Native Alaskans, Native Americans. What does it mean for us in Western culture, for those of us who are living in urban areas? Is there another way for us to engage with non-human nature? For us to reinvent nature in a meaningful way that takes into consideration some of these ideas. Well, one example of a woman who is trying to do this is a woman who lives in New York, a New York artist named Rhonda Shearer. And she points out that New York is probably the most denatured place on the planet. It epitomizes the modern global environmental crisis. And yet, the way she thinks about nature and the way she portrays it in her art suggests that we don't necessarily have to look back to tradition, to say the pre-modern world, but we ourselves in the Western world can find a way to participate in nature. We can put our hands in it. It can become tactile. We can hear it. We can talk to it, much as these earlier examples of pre-modern peoples. And she chooses plants. Plants, she says, have never been the subject of art. Very rarely, other than botanists, have plants become the subject of sculpture, for example. And so she, in her studio, makes these various leaves and stems and parts of plants, and she puts them into patterns in these networks, in these grids, which are meant to portray the ideas of the postmodern scientific world of fractal geometry and of chaos theory. And she believes that our bodies, our intestines, our kidneys, our heart, are examples of fractal-like substances, that they can be understood through fractal geometry and fractal mathematics. But fractals throw off our usual sense of two-dimensionality and three-dimensionality and confound our usual notions of separation. She uses plants and fractal ideas and ideas of chaos theory here in a work. This portrays a woman, and this is a woman that's something like 10 or 12 feet high, which she has made in her studio. It is larger than life, and she took me to the art gallery where this figure was located, and you could walk up to it and you could touch these plants which entwine and encircle through this woman's body so that she is part of the plant world. You could put your hands through the sculpture. Some of these are very barely three-dimensional. They're almost two dimensions, but they have a slight depth to them, so that they are both two and three dimensions in one. And this woman is using a vacuum cleaner. And she uses the vacuum cleaner to indicate that this is part of our everyday life. It's part of our world. Our world is also interactive and participatory. She has done a number of examples like this of women ironing and of women caring for children, and also figures of men, again, intertwined and interlaced with the plant world. These ideas that she is trying to capture in her artwork come from the new science, from ideas about chaos and ideas about fractals. Chaos theory, I think, suggests something extremely important for us as we try to draw a lesson, as we try to understand these disparate images that I've shown here that jar us in their differences, in that dislocate us, that suggest other times and other places. For it is chaos theory that suggests to us that our Newtonian world, our mechanistic worldview, the world on which this whole Earth's image is based, describes only the usual, or the rather the unusual situation, the situation where we can predict and control, but that most cases are unusual. Much of the world, most of the world, is unpredictable, is chaotic, as captured in the idea of the butterfly image, which says that a flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil can result in a tornado in Texas. This idea of chaos theory means that we can't predict and control everything. And it suggests to me the need and the basis for a new ethic. What these pre-modern world views, these pre-modern ways of being in the world tell us, or they tell me, that world of nature, of non-human nature, is an active, alive, immediate presence. It is a living subject that we engage with as another subject. Non-human nature, I think, needs to be reinvented in our Western consciousness as an equal participatory subject, a subject that is chaotic, that is unpredictable, that surprises us. And if we leave room for that surprise, for that unpredictability, we realize that we don't have this total power to dominate and control nature. In the Newtonian worldview, yes, we have the science and technology that allowed us to go to the moon, that allowed us to go to outer space and take photographs of the whole Earth and create this whole Earth image, which gives us that sense of total domination and control. So we recognize that through science and technology, we can do this. We do have this power over nature that Francis Bacon talked about in the early 17th century. But nature, non-human nature, has equal power over us. Because if we go too far, if we build dams on every single river, if we cut down all our forests, if we plant monocultures on all our soil and the wind blows it away, our science and technology will leave us with nothing that will support and sustain life as we know it. If we instead treat nature as an equal subject, not as a representation of an object, it is equal to us. And we then create a partnership relationship with non-human nature, a reciprocity and an interaction. This partnership ethic, I believe, will treat, just as it treats human beings, as partners in personal relationships, in households, in political relations, including men and other men, women and other women as partners. It treats human partners with respect, with nurturing, and we give each other as partners, time and care, and we allow each other to grow and develop individually and in non-dominating relationships. So we must, in this new partnership ethic with nature, treat non-human nature as if it were another human being, another subject. We give it time to reproduce, to evolve, to respond to human actions. We give it space and time and care. We allow time for surprise, for chaotic development. And what would this ethic mean in practice? In practice, it would mean not cutting forests and damming rivers that make people and wildlife vulnerable to so-called natural disturbances or natural disasters. It would mean curtailing development in areas where we have volcanoes and hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes, which would allow room for unpredictable, chaotic, and natural surprises. It would mean exercising ethical restraint in introducing new technologies, such as pesticides and genetically engineered organisms and biological weapons into ecosystems. We would reinvent, we would reconstruct nature as an equal partner, allowing for the possibility then of a personal and intimate relationship with non-human nature, not necessarily a spiritual relationship, but one where we could express and feel compassion. And it would allow us then to see nature in terms of rapture, of compassion, of total immersion, and the sense of reciprocity and egalitarianism. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, I have to be disconnected from technology now and transported to another space, where I will come to you by remote control.
There's going to be a change of plan. We're going to invite the people from the other room in here. We think there's enough room to bring them in. So we're going to reconnect.
Take a couple minutes, but I think we can probably get started.
Okay. Well, I think that nature changes its meaning over time. It is constructed differently by different peoples. And so it does not have one uniform meaning. Spinoza gave it a meaning in the 17th century in terms of the natural laws of the universe. And physics assumes that meaning. So that was not the meaning of nature that other peoples had. And I think we have to recognize that the worldview of Spinoza and of Isaac Newton is not the only way to relate to nature, and there are other equally perhaps valid ways, though they may not be the same as Western science. So I would like to suggest that if we continue in the direction that the Newtonian worldview has pointed us, even though we don't have to give that up, but the assumption that nature is made up of atoms, which are inert parts and they're moved by external forces, the idea that God is a clockmaker and an engineer, and that as humans we are imitators of that approach, that we can repair and fix the world from the outside, which is one of the basic assumptions of that scientific worldview. We also have to recognize that that scientific worldview is changing right before us in the 20th century. It's changing through relativity theory and quantum theory, which suggests that when human beings observe a quantum, or they observe an electron with a quantum of energy, it changes the location, or it changes the momentum of that particle. So there is a participation of human beings right there in the world, and an interaction with it built into modern physics. The physics of Prigogine and of David Bohm are further suggesting a deconstruction of that mechanistic worldview, that there is a basic process-oriented view of nature, that process is more fundamental than parts. Bohm talks about the holo movement as being fundamental and as being life implicit. So this is still physics, it's still science, but it is a science with very different assumptions at its root than that of the fathers of the scientific revolution. So nature and science change over time, and so do we as a society with a culture and a politics. And what I'd like to leave you with is the idea that that idea of nature can be actively reinvented in such a way that it sustains human life on the planet rather than destroying it. Yes. Well, I can just put a few of them on as we're questioning, but I don't have them in the same order anymore. So as I'm answering questions, I can just put some of these on the screen. Yes. Yes. Do I consider human beings to be part of nature? Absolutely. We are definitely part of nature. And okay. Well, we are separate in one way, and we are part of it in another way. I mean, our bodies are organic, and we need food, clothing, and shelter, which come from the non-human nature, and that we are part of the biogeochemical cycles which flow through the natural world and flow through our bodies. We also, however, through our culture, have the ability to engage in producing from nature, through our production systems, through our mines, and through our mills, and through our factories. And so nature then becomes raw material, which is transformed into something else, into an artifact or commodity, or what some people have called the transformation of first nature into second nature. And in that sense, even though it is still part of the physical world, it is taken out of these biogeochemical cycles, and it's multiplied in terms of economic transformation and into commodities, which are then sold. So that we are both separate from it in our ability to transform it, and we are connected to it in terms of the need for sustenance from it. So I'm calling it, when I say non-human nature, I'm recognizing that it's nature, and so are we nature. We, as Susan Griffin says, we are nature regarding nature. And I think that's the message here. We're connected to it, and yet we're also disconnected from it. And a lot of our assumptions emphasize that separateness and emphasize that disconnection from it. Yes. That's true. That's where nature has power over us. But we also have power over non-human nature. And we have such tremendous power over it through the developments, especially since the Industrial Revolution, and through all this communication technology, and through our global transport systems, that can change life as we know it for human beings. I mean, it might not wipe out life, but we have the capacity to totally undermine our own basis for continuance, for our own continued reproduction as human beings, or of life as we know it now. Nuclear war can do that. That's a human power over non-human nature. It would wipe out a lot of other species besides us. So I'm saying we need to recognize we have that power. We also have to recognize nature, non-human nature, has that power. And that's where the egalitarian ethic comes from. Yes. If it comes to a choice between retaining the beauty and rapture of nature and mass killings of human beings, what choice would I make? I don't think that we have to we will have to make that choice. What you're talking about in your question, I think, implies not only age distribution, but population pressures, population increase, and that's a tremendously important and absolutely non-trivial problem. Population issues are absolutely critical. And the question is, how is development going to take place? Is it going to continue in the way it has taken place, at least over the last few decades, where much of the third world resources have brought to North America and consumed by those of us who live in this highly developed technological society and highly consumer-oriented society? Is it possible for development to take place in a way that's sustainable, that does not undercut that basis of support, our whole life support system on the planet? And is it possible for it to take place in such a way that there is also social justice and equity for people in the developing world and for the homeless people in our life, in our city, right here and in San Francisco? And a lot of that depends on what kind of political and economic decisions we make. But just going about and, you know, issuing mass birth control, or as you would call it, mass killing, is not going to solve anything, because if the people, suppose you reduce the population down to 10% of what it is now. And you maintain the same level of consumer-oriented society that we have now, those same resources would still be destroyed and transformed to give everybody this same standard of living that we have now. So a lot of lifestyle choices are at stake here, as well as new ways of going about development, such as sustainable forestry practices, agroforestry, which is a whole new science of integrating animals and plants and crops with trees, of sustainable agriculture, of biological methods of controlling insect pests, which have evolved with people for hundreds of years, of planting polycultures together, of restoration ecology, of bioregionalism. All these are new kinds of methods that are being explored in a very scientific way and a very ecological way, based on the concept of process and transformation, and based on this idea that process is more fundamental than parts. So it isn't something where we have to come down to as devastating a choice as that. It's a question of how this transition is going to be made into the 21st century. And I argue that we can, through all these new ideas, through these new methods of production, that we can bring about an ecological revolution such that over the next two or three decades, or maybe by the middle of the next century, we will have a sustainable world. We will have a world in which our great-grandchildren will learn a different approach, a different science and a different technology than the one in which we grew up.
I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, I'm an engineer, and I build dams. And when I see these images, such as this image here, I don't necessarily see something cold and inhuman. I see thousands of people at work. I see a lot of focus, I see a lot of drive, determination, a lot of very human qualities. I find there's an implicit in your presentation that you see the use of pesticides, the damming of rivers, the cutting of forests as unethical, that these are almost evil because they're so abstracted from humanity. And I would perhaps challenge that these are actually products of humanity. And that the logical consequence of these is not total control, that the satellite that you showed there is not only can be used for understanding the whole Earth, but it can be used in understanding the earthquakes, in understanding the volcanoes, in defining the design, and perhaps also in science and with the application of Newton with measurement, that rather than to abandon measurement, and to abandon science, and abandon technology, which seems to be the thrust of a lot of the concern, is actually to have it to serve all people and not just those who perhaps pay the bills. And for me to see that happening is that you actually have to value and measure the non-tangible, the qualities that the Aboriginal in Australia has. And it's not, an abandonment of Newton. It's actually bringing that into science and bringing that into value. Perhaps if I could just ask for perhaps a comment.
Well,
one last thing on that, and that's that in, with science and with technology, that at the moment we see industry as having a source, a natural source, and an end product, which which goes into basically perhaps despoiling nature, goes into a landfill, goes into polluting a river and destroying an ecosystem. And yet as a chemist, we know that matter is neither created nor destroyed. And closing those two loops and making it a cyclic process is completely within the bounds of technology. But to do that, you have to place a value on the resource and a value on where you put it. And until that value gets recognized in the commodity market, then that won't happen.
Yes.
Can you summarize that? Well, a little difficult.
It's just perhaps a different view of it.
Am I suggesting that we have to abandon science and technology and engineering, or can we not think of it as closing the loop by valuing what is there in nature, non-human nature, and bringing that value, putting that value somehow into the loop? And I am not suggesting that we can or that it's possible to abandon science and technology or abandon the Newtonian worldview. It is here. It is useful. It is important. What I'm suggesting is that recognizing that the Newtonian worldview, the engineered world, is a small domain of what is there, and those descriptions apply to that small domain. Science is much bigger than that. It's much more complex, and we haven't certainly even begun to comprehend it, and what chaos theory is suggesting is that we can't, and that we need to recognize that there is a limit, that there is no way that we can really close that gap. I agree with you completely. We need to put a value on some of these intangible things, which I've been talking about with Aboriginal people and Koyukon people and Zulu and so on. Those are really qualitative. And if there is a way to value that doesn't reduce it just to some number to complete the loop, we absolutely need to. And what you're saying, I think, is very close to what I'm advocating about a partnership relationship, because it's when you do recognize that one needs to introduce value into it, to feeling and perception, but in a different way than the Newtonian model has allowed us to do so far, I think then we get a new ethic, a new relationship that will allow us to sustain life on the planet. Thanks.
I'd like to call upon Professor Hector Williams of the UBC Department of Classics to thank our speaker tonight.
Professor Merchant, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, more than 40 years ago, I was a child growing up on the western shores of Hudson Bay. Nature was all around us. We took it rather for granted. The white bear came, the white whale came, the seals came, caribou came. It was an unusual experience to hear the lecture tonight in the context of living in British Columbia, where we have many of the same features, which we take less for granted now. But I think it's really important that we have speakers like Professor Merchant to come out and talk to us tonight, and the interest The vital concern of a large number of people is attested by the hundreds that came out to hear her tonight. Nature is something that is with us, but our views change and must continue to change. And it's to the credit of our speaker and her colleagues, and to our universities, and to the concerned organizations of the world today, that we are trying to reinvent nature. And I think that your talk tonight has made it much clearer to many of us just how important that is. Thank you.